work I'm going to be reporting on was done in collaboration with several people, including George Dragofsky, Chris O'Day, Freddie Karp, Steffi Baum, Kenny Friedman, undergraduate student Eddie Baum, and Eddie Guerra, and Matt Morey, another undergraduate student. And this talk is divided into three parts. I'm going to start out with a phenomenological approach to using data to study cosmology. Okay, so it's a phenomenological approach, and I'm going to illustrate it using a supernova data set and a radio galaxy data set. I'm going to talk about the physics of powerful radio galaxies and how they're used for cosmology, and also what we learn about the supermassive black holes that are powering radio galaxies. And finally, I'll talk about solving for the spins of these supermassive black holes. So everybody now knows that the acceleration of the universe can be studied using distance measurements to any type of source, such as supernova and radio galaxies. The supernova and radio galaxy methods are completely independent and complementary. So to illustrate the kind of common approach to using this data for cosmology, I'm going to use the data set of Davis et al. Okay, there's 192 sources in that sample. So this is the Davis et al. Sample, which is the 182 supernova of Ries et al. Plus their high redshift supernovae of Ries et al. Astier et al. Plus Ries et al. I'll also talk about the Kowalski data. So this is primarily to illustrate how this data is used for cosmology, and then talk about how the data can be used to study cosmology in a model-independent way. Okay. I'll be comparing results obtained with supernova with results obtained with radio galaxies, and the full data set I'm using is a combination of the two. So the radio galaxies are shown here as solid symbols, and they dominate the high redshift sample. The supernova are shown as open symbols. These are coordinate distances. I like to use dimensionless coordinate distances because they're independent of any measures of Hubble's constant locally. So they're independent of the local distance scale. Okay. These coordinate distances, as I'll show in a minute, are obtained directly from the data without any assumptions about a cosmological model. Okay. All of the distance measures that we have, the coordinate distance, the luminosity distance, and the angular size distance, are all carry the same information as far as cosmology goes. Okay, they only differ by factors of 1 plus z, and at this point we have redshifts for all of the sources in the samples. As you know, the supernova method of obtaining the coordinate distance relies on correcting the effective apparent magnitude of the supernova at peak. So M sub B effective is the effective apparent magnitude, how bright the supernova appears to be to us at its peak, that is then corrected using a multicolor light curve technique or a stretch technique. And that's indicated by this parameter alpha, which is determined independently. Okay, so we're not solving simultaneously for the cosmology and the parameter that is used to correct the supernova. And all this is equal to the absolute brightness of the supernova at its peak. This is what's called the nuisance parameter. In fact, you can see it clearly is not a nuisance. It is required to solve for the coordinate distances to sources. Sometimes this absorbs Hubble's constant, so writing this as a dimensionless quantity rather than the coordinate distance A naught R, in that case the Hubble's constant is absorbed into this and it's called capital M prime. Okay, or you can write the full coordinate distance here, A naught R, in which case that is the absolute magnitude of the supernova at peak. The radio galaxy method is very, very similar. We have observables indicated by K0, K1, and K2. These are observed quantities, and I'll be returning to these later. And we have the coordinate distance Y. This expression is equal to a constant, much the same way that the absolute magnitude of the supernova at peak is a constant. So in this case, though, the model parameter is embedded in this equation, and we solve for both the cosmology and the model parameter simultaneously. Okay? Now, this is an empirically determined relationship. This is not just something we picked out of the air and said, oh, this fits the data, let's try this. And we actually understand the physics and the physical basis for writing this down. Okay? When I talk about the radio galaxies, there's 30 in our current sample, and we just completed a run where we have 13 more sources, so those will be coming soon. Now, how do you use data of this type for cosmology? Well, there's the commonly adopted approach, which is you make a whole series of assumptions, and then you solve for best fit model parameters. So in this approach, you need to select the model you're studying in advance. Okay? So you have your coordinate distance. This is what you're measuring or what you're getting directly from the data, as I just showed. Okay? This is your model prediction, A dot over A. So to get to this model prediction, first you assume a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. You assume a theory of gravity, generally taken to be GR. You select a specific dark energy model. Generally, we take only two components in the universe, dark energy and non-relativistic matter, baryons and dark matter included in that term. Okay, and then we solve for our best fit model parameters. So for example, for zero space curvature, we have A dot over A squared is this equation. We pick something for the dark energy, could be quintessence, shown here with constant W, could be something with evolving W. There are many, many different things you can put in for the energy density of the dark energy as a function of redshift. You then take this expression, you put it in here, and you integrate out to the redshift of each source. And you get your predicted value of Y by integrating out to the redshift of each source for A dot over A for that model, and you minimize the difference between your predicted Y and your observed Y for each source in your sample. So that's the standard approach that's used. As I mentioned, it requires that you make several assumptions in advance and that you're solving for the model parameters of one particular model. Okay? So if you're just looking at supernova and not combining with another data set, this is actually a data set of supernova plus radio galaxies, you can constrain the equation of state and the energy density in non-relativistic matter today, omega matter, and this line is separating the accelerating region from the decelerating region. Okay? And you can clearly see that in this model, the universe is accelerating today. This is a standard quintessence model with constant W. These lines here are for the radio galaxies, and they also show independently at less significance, but still like 92% confidence or something like that, that the universe is accelerating today in that model. Okay, we also considered a rolling scalar field model. That's another model you can consider. And here we find that the parameter of the rolling scalar field is has a best fit value of zero. That is to say, a cosmological constant is a good description of the data in that, in the context of that particular model. Okay? You can also consider models with non-zero space curvature, in which case you have both an integral on both sides of the equation. On the left-hand side now, just instead of A naught R, or our coordinate distance Y, we now integrate out to the redshift of each source, including a term for space curvature. But it's basically the same idea. You make all these assumptions, you pick a model, and then you solve for the best fit parameters of that model. Okay? Once you have space curvature, generally you're looking at a cosmological constant model because these are your two parameters. In all of these instances, you can really only solve for two parameters. So it's either W and omega matter, or omega lambda and omega k, or W of z, and you find omega matter from some other method. Okay? So in those particular models, and in most models that have been considered, it looks like the universe is accelerating today. But the question is the universe accelerating? Can we say whether or not it's accelerating independent of any one particular model? Okay? And the way that you can do that is by studying the coordinate distance and the first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance. And what I showed with George Rogowski is that, yes, you can use the data itself and make one assumption, that the universe is described by a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, and you can solve for the expansion rate of the universe as a function of redshift, so you're now going to solve for A dot over A, and you can also solve for Q of Z, minus A double dot A over A dot squared. And these little ticks are dots. Just couldn't get word to put that up on the screen. say my tough word. So this is Q of z. Okay, so basically, now you have one assumption, and you can solve for h of z and q of z, and you can determine whether or not the universe is accelerating today. Now, how can you do that? Well, this follows right from the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. Okay, and that metric indicates the relationship between time, the time element, and the distance element. This is for k equals 0, and we can certainly do this for k not equal to 0, and we have. And there's a relationship between a dot over a normalized to the current value and the first derivative of the coordinate distance, and space curvature. Okay? And this, in fact, is buried in Steven Weinberg's book. It's in there. You have to look for it, but you can find it, and you have to manipulate things a little bit, but it is there. Now you can take another derivative of this. Now you have a dot over a. Okay, that's what this is, a dot over a normalized to the value today. You can take another derivative of that and manipulate the equations and solve for q of z. Again, the only assumption is that you have a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. You solve for q of z, and it looks like this. Okay, so q of z for zero space curvature is just this part. It depends on the first derivative of the coordinate distance, the second derivative of the coordinate distance, and the redshift to the source. Okay, and we can include space curvature here also. All right, so you can solve for h of z and q of z without ever saying anything about the contents of the universe, without ever specifying a theory of gravity, and even without saying anything about space curvature. So in order to implement this method, you have to be able to obtain the first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance. And that's done. We tried many, many different methods, George Rogowski and I, and they all gave the same result. So we just decided to go with the simplest. Okay, so all the different methods give similar results. These illustrate the data points. We take a window function, and we fit a quadratic, or we do a Taylor expansion about a point z naught using the data in here, and obtain y of z naught, y prime, and y double prime at that point. So we get the coordinate distance and the first and second derivatives, and then we move along and get those at all at each point. So applying that to, this is just for comparison, we applied that to three supernova samples. These were the ones available a year ago, and one radio galaxy sample. And this line here with the bars illustrates y of z and its one sigma uncertainty. So you can see that in each of these. That's what you get for y of z at that redshift and a one sigma uncertainty. And superimposed in that are the data that were used to get those results. Now, we do not use a cosmological model for that, but in all these figures, we compare to a standard lambda CDM model with omega matter of 0.3. And that's what that solid line illustrates. Then we can look at the first derivative, okay, with respect to redshift. And this is what we get for these different supernova samples. Okay, there's a lot of overlap between the supernova in these samples, okay, and the radio galaxies. Okay, so these look like they're described quite well by a standard lambda CDM model. And these are the second derivatives. So these are going to be the ingredients that we use to solve for h of z and q of z. Okay, so these are the different supernova samples. And we'll get the Kowalski et al. Data in a minute. All right, so there's good agreement between GR, what's predicted by GR, and what we're getting. So these results that we have for Y prime and Y double prime, and also for Y, you know, they do not have a theory of gravity in them. They don't have anything in them at all. They're just coming directly from the data. And you can see this black line, which is what is predicted by general relativity with a cosmological constant, is providing a good fit to those results. And also, we have good agreement between the results obtained with supernova and radio galaxies, two completely different methods. Now, the union data of Kowalski et al. Is shown here. Okay, and there is starting to appear to be a bit of a discrepancy, small discrepancy, between the first derivative of the coordinate distance here and the model. Nothing to be too terribly alarmed about. And here's the second derivative with respect to redshift. Okay, so So it looks like there's a very slight kind of one sigma deviation popping up at a redshift of about 0.7 to 0.9, probably having a lot more to do with the data and the analysis methods than any real deviations from the standard cosmological model. All right, if we now use those ingredients, the first derivative of the coordinate distance, to solve for h of z normalized to the value today, this is what we get. Okay, so this is what you get for the 192 supernova plus 30 radio galaxies. And this determination of h of z has nothing in it except the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker line element. Okay, there's no assumption about gravity. There's no assumption about the contents of the universe or their evolution. No, there is an assumption of zero space curvature, and I'll talk about non-zero space curvature in a minute. But you can see this thin, solid black line here, which is what is predicted by GR and a lambda CDM model with omega matter 0.3, is providing an extremely good description of the data out to redshifts of about 1.2. Now, if we allow for non-zero space curvature, this top panel here is showing space curvature equal to zero, and this is allowing for space curvature to be 0.1 or minus 0.1. So, you know, we don't want to have huge values, which are already ruled out by other observations, such as the cosmic microwave background. But you can see the effect is very, very small. So the zero space curvature line would be between these two. So the effect of H of Z of space curvature is very small. Okay, and it has no effect at zero redshift. Okay, and this is not set equal to one at zero redshift. That's an out. That's something you get out of the analysis. It's not something that we put in. Q of z, we can look at that for zero space curvature. And again, so this determination of Q of z is coming from the first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance plugged into this expression here. These are one sigma error bars, and this is the best fit value in the middle here, okay? And this is what you would get from a standard lambda CDM model with GR and a cosmological constant, okay? So it's a pretty strong statement. I mean, you can see clearly GR and a cosmological constant is providing an excellent fit to the data. All right, and radio galaxies give a similar result with a larger uncertainty. This gives a four sigma detection of the acceleration today. Okay, so in a completely model-independent way. So it doesn't matter what's in the universe. You can have anything you want in the universe. You can have evolving any way you want. You can have any theory of gravity. The only thing you need here is a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric. And that's the conclusion. The universe is accelerating today at four sigma. In terms of where it transitions from acceleration to deceleration, does require specification of space curvature. And for zero space curvature, it's transitioning at a redshift of about 0.8 from an accelerating phase to a decelerating phase. Now again, it was interesting to put in some values for space curvature, and we picked 0.1 and minus 0.1. and found that the effect on Q of z was very, very small. In addition, there's no effect on Q naught. The zero redshift value of Q is independent of space curvature. Okay? So, well, what this is saying is that for reasonable values of space curvature at four sigma, the universe is accelerating today and was decelerating in the recent past. On this figure, again, these are the best fit Q of z. The one sigma error bars are very similar to the one sigma error bars obtained with k equal to zero, and they're not included on this figure, so you can see what the best fit looks like for the two different values of omega k, plus or minus 0.1. Now, we can also look at the union data set of Kowalski et al., and we have similar results. Okay, very small deviation here showing up in h of z, and something happening here with Q of z, okay? It's not even one sigma for Q of z. Okay, and in this analysis, I have not included the radio galaxies. Radio galaxies can really pull the error bars down at high redshift because most of them are at redshifts greater than one. Okay, Now, another quantity that we like to look at is called the dark energy indicator. This is another model-independent quantity. Okay, so the idea is that we want to look at model-independent quantities that don't depend on the contents of the universe or how they evolve, and hopefully do not depend on the gravitational theory. So the dark energy indicator is another parameter that we consider, and we proposed this in our 2008 paper. This is a combination of the second derivative of the coordinate distance and the first derivative of the coordinate distance and the redshift. Okay, so that's how it's constructed. We compare that to the predicted value. So we now go to a standard, what's called an XCDM model. So this is a model where it's based on general relativity. It does allow for W to be any function of redshift, so it is not constrained. W is not constrained to be constant. It can be any function of redshift, as the dark energy density can be any function of redshift, and omega matter, or rho matter, can be any function of redshift. Of course, we usually take it to be 1 plus z cubed, but here it can be anything. In that model, the predicted value of S, the dark energy indicator, comes in as a term W plus 1. Okay, so it's a constant, minus 1.5 omega matter. Okay, so omega matter is constant. It's the zero redshift value of omega matter. And if W is equal to minus 1, we would expect S to be constant. So if we solve for S and find that it's constant, it's an indicator that W is equal to minus 1. Okay? And if it is constant, then it provides a new and independent measure of omega matter. So we solve for S using this equation, and if it turns out to be constant, it would indicate in a standard model based on GR and an XCDM model that W is equal to minus 1, and we can solve for omega matter. So using the Davis-Hall data set plus the 30 radio galaxies, this is what we found for S. Okay, so it appears to be constant, and these are the lines that S is predicted to be. This is the line predicted for W equals minus 1 and omega matter of 0.3. Okay, this is what is predicted for W is constant, but minus 1.2. We would get this curve for S. And if W is constant at minus 0.8, we would get this curve for S. So we see these curves diverge quite strongly at zero redshift, and zero redshift measures of S can significantly constrain models. If we select a value for omega matter, we can solve for W naught. Okay, so if we pick omega matter 0.3, this tells us that W naught is minus 0.95 plus or minus 0.08. That's what we get from this right here. Or we can pick omega matter. We can say W is equal to minus 1 and solve for omega matter. Now we're working in the context of a particular model. Okay, but our measure of S is model independent. Okay, this is coming from the first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance and shown right here, and the redshift. Okay. This is S from Kowalski et al. Okay, so it looks like there's a very, very large error bars coming in here. So we might not really believe the results much past here. Okay, and I think what's happening is in the supernova data sets, there's the issue of which light curve technique to use, and they're starting to give different results, and which data points to keep, and which data points to throw out. Those choices are starting to have an impact on the cosmological results. Now, we also separated the data into independent redshift bins and considered them in independent redshift bins. How am I doing on time? Okay, because I have several other topics. All right, I'll just go through this kind of quickly. What we did was we divided the data into independent redshift bins, and we did that in three different ways. Okay, so we took the 222 sources, the 30 radio galaxies plus 192 supernova, and divided them into independent redshift bins so that our uncertainties are uncorrelated. In the previous results I was showing you, the error bars are correlated. So the range of the redshift of the data points that go into each point are shown by these horizontal error uncertainties. These are not really uncertainties. These are the range of the redshift of the points that went into the data point obtained here. Okay? So we took the data and divided them into bins having the same number of data points per bin. And we determined each quantity at the median redshift of the bin. Could have picked any point within a bin, we just picked the median redshift. Okay? So those are shown here with one sigma error bars. Okay? And this is the lambda CDM prediction with omega matter of 0.3. Okay, so we get y prime and y double prime, and then we can use them to get h of z and q of z. Okay? So we continue to see very, very good agreement between the data and the lambda CDM model. There is some sensitivity to the way the data are bent. Okay? And so the goal is to keep dividing these into smaller and smaller size bins until the results are not sensitive to the binning. Q of Z, interestingly, showed no acceleration today. So that was a little startling. And it just means that we don't really have enough data to confirm the acceleration of the universe today using bin data. Okay? So we had to use a significant amount of data in order to see that the universe was accelerating today. Now, if you want to, you can turn things around and use your first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance to solve for the properties of the dark energy. So rather than picking a particular dark energy model, you're going to use the data to solve for the pressure of the dark energy density, the energy density of the dark energy, and the equation state of the dark energy. Okay? So now we are going to select the theory of gravity, general relativity, and set space curvature equal to zero. Here, the dark energy, indicated by capital E, we consider it to be the sum of everything other than non-relativistic matter. Okay? So in these equations, rho m is non-relativistic matter, including dark matter and baryons. And this little e, these terms, are the sum of everything else. Maybe there's just one dark energy component, or maybe there's more than one. These are the sum of everything else. You can easily substitute this part of this expression into here and solve for the pressure of the dark energy, or the sum of the pressures of all the other components. Okay? And you can see that that's just a simple combination of first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance. Okay? So the assumptions here are Friedman, Robertson, Walker metric, GR is a good description of our universe, and space curvature is equal to zero. And this is what you get for the pressure of the dark energy. Okay? So this is the best fit value of the pressure, shown as the solid line here. The very thin solid line is the lambda CDM prediction. And these are the one sigma error bars. Okay? To solve for the energy density of the dark energy and the equation of state, you need to specify a value for omega matter. Okay, and we picked omega matter of 0.3. So you can see right away you can use this equation right here to solve for the energy density of the dark energy. You have to specify a value for omega matter. These are what we have directly from the data in terms of our first and second derivatives of the coordinate distance. Okay, so we have observed quantities on this side, and we're solving for the energy density here, and then we can take the ratio of the pressure to the energy density to solve for the equation of state. Okay, so that's what we get. So lambda CDM is looking pretty good here. Okay? And these are the Kowalski et al. Results using their data. Okay. So it looks like the data set is giving believable answers out to a redshift of about 0.6 or 0.7. And then there's large fluctuations, large uncertainties starting to set in to that data set because of the lack of high redshift data points. We can also solve for the potential and kinetic energy densities of dark energy scalar field. Okay. And it looks like V is flat, as expected for a cosmological constant, and the kinetic energy density is zero. Okay? And the Kowalski et al. Data give a similar result. All right. So as I mentioned before, it looks like the supernova data is reaching a point where the light curve fitting technique is starting to have an impact, and you're getting different results with different light curve fitting techniques. And it also looks like it's, the K correction may be becoming significant. Okay? This is the correction that you have to apply, because when you look at high redshift data points, you're looking at emission closer to the ultraviolet in the restroom of the source. And the most of the light curve determinations are done at low redshift, where it's more in the optical and the near infrared. All right, I think I'll just say a brief word about the history of the subject. It's been about 10 years, now 10 plus a little bit, since the acceleration of the universe was announced by the supernova groups, and I'd like to point out that I also announced this. I announced this at the January AAS meeting. There's recently been some going back and forth in the APS news about this. So at the January AAS meeting, Saul Perlmutter was there, and Adam Reese was there, and I was there, and several other people, and I did announce that the expanding universe was going to expand more and more rapidly as time goes on. Okay, and I put that later in my press release also. Okay, so the radio galaxy at that time, radio galaxy data at that time indicated that the universe would expand forever and would expand at a faster and faster rate as time went by. Okay, and those are the results that I based that conclusion on. These are the data. So this is the accelerating part of the plane here, and this is the decelerating part of the plane. I was able to draw that conclusion primarily because of these high redshift data points. And these the radio galaxy data have gone out to very, very high redshifts for a long time. These data points were here in 1998. Okay. At the time, there was a concern that this was only a conclusion you could draw in the context of a particular model. At that time, we were looking at a model with space curvature, a cosmological constant, non-relativistic matter. Okay? So that was a concern. Would the acceleration of the universe be there in other models, and was there a model-independent way to study it? And I think that the model-independent results that we have now do clearly demonstrate that the universe is accelerating today in a model-independent way. Now, I wanted to mention a little bit about the radio galaxy method and how radio galaxies can be used for cosmology. And then this will go right into determining the spins of the supermassive black holes that power radio galaxies. So how many people here are familiar with radio galaxies? One. Okay, good. We have one. So, radio galaxies are a very, very interesting class of object to study, and like most objects, there's many, many different types. And we study one very particular type of radio galaxy. They're the most powerful radio galaxies. We study these because they're growing at a rate that's supersonic. And that means we can apply strong shock physics to them, which is very simple and easy and not messy at all. So we're studying the sources that look like this, that are growing at a rate that's large compared to the sound speed of the ambient medium. Okay, so this is a radio image of a radio galaxy. It's called a radio galaxy because when you look in the optical, you see the optical galaxy. And when you look in the radio, you see this huge radio-emitting region that's generally much, much larger than the optical galaxy. A famous example is Cygnus A. And this is Cygnus A in the radio. This is a supermassive black hole. Okay, it has a mass of about 1 billion solar masses. It's putting out these relativistic jets that carry a beam power, energy per unit time, from the black hole to the extremities of the source. And they dump that energy, okay, into what's called the hot spot. And this whole region here is a strong shock. Over time, this gets larger. Okay, as time goes by, this gets larger. And these sources are very, very well behaved and really nice to study. If you look at take a complete sample of these sources and look at their sizes, they're very, very well behaved. They have a very small dispersion at a given redshift. So this is the average size of the sources defined to be the hotspot size. Okay, so you take all of the FR2B sources, those are the most powerful sources that are growing supersonically, take a complete sample of them and solve for the average size as a function of redshift. And you find they're small today, okay? This is about 70 kiloparsecs. They jump up at a redshift of about 0.5, and then they decline monotonically, and the way they decline, of course, depends on the cosmology. Okay, so, but in any case, they're getting smaller in any cosmological model. And they maintain a small dispersion at a given redshift. No matter what the cosmological model is, there's a small dispersion at a given redshift. So they're a very homogeneous population. And they get smaller as you go to high redshift. Now, if you look at the rate of growth of the sources, how fast they're growing, which we can measure using the radio data, they're certainly not decreasing with redshift. Okay, there's no statistically significant correlation with speed and redshift. If anything, by eye, you'd say they're increasing, but they're certainly not decreasing. So that told me and my collaborators that the standard assumption that's been applied for these sources, and in fact is still applied by many, many different groups today, that they all live for the same time, cannot be right. Okay? So frequently people assume that a given radio source is on for what's called the Eddington time. Well, that's the same for every source. The Eddington time is a constant. It's around 10 to the 8 years. And you can see from these two plots that there's no way that these sources are on for the same amount of time, because they're getting smaller as you go to higher redshift, but they're growing at a rate which is certainly not decreasing with redshift. The higher redshift sources are more powerful, and they're growing more rapidly. And these are the same sources that went into that other plot. Okay, so that told us right away they do not all live for the same amount of time. So we decided to generalize this Eddington-limited time and write the total time the AGN is on, that's the black hole at the center producing the relativistic jets, to write that as a power law on the beam power. Now, there are many different ways to come to this conclusion, and I'm telling you the simplest. There are other mathematical ways that it's obvious that this is the choice you want to make, but it would take a while to explain all those details, so I'm going to gloss over that. Okay, so we just guess that the total time the AGN is on is a power law on the beam power, and then the standard Eddington time is a special case. If beta is equal to zero, then these sources are all on for the Eddington time, 10 to the 8 years. Okay, so writing this down, the size of a given source is its speed times the time it's on. We put in the beam power here, Lj minus beta over 3, and so we have the average size of a given source. You can write it down like this. These are observables, the rate of growth of the source we get from the radio data. This is the width of the forward shock front, which we get directly from the data, and the pressure also comes directly from the data. Okay, so this has one model parameter, beta. And we could have guessed this. We could have just said, you know what, we're just going to guess that the average size of a source is given by this equation. But in fact, this equation is motivated by other considerations. So then we say the average size of the full population has to track the average size of a given source. Or maybe say it the other way around, the average size of a given source tracks the full population. So this ratio should be constant. When you write down this ratio, it basically goes as the coordinate distance to the 1.6 power. It's a lot like the supernova test, where the parameter you're solving for goes as the coordinate distance squared. Okay, the apparent brightness versus your guess at the intrinsic brightness is going as 1 plus z squared. I mean, 1 plus, it's going as a naught r squared. So this has a very similar power. So you solve for d star for each source using your model parameter and including the way the cosmology enters each of these terms. And you require that this ratio be constant. And what you get out is the cosmological model, solve for the cosmological model, or rather you get the coordinate distance to each source and your model parameter beta. That's what you get out of this. Okay? So there's only a few assumptions that go in. This is one of the key assumptions here, the relationship between the total time the AGN is on and the beam power. And this is what the most recent results look like for our 30 radio galaxies. Here is D star. Okay, so D star, the way this is going to evolve with redshift is going to depend on the cosmology. All right, and the model parameter beta. This is the the quantity that is supposed to be constant. Average of D over D star, and we see that it is constant. This is shown here for a quintessence model. Okay? So one of the neat things we get out of this, I'll skip forward, is beta, the model parameter beta. That's telling us about the physics of the supermassive black holes. So our model parameter beta, we can solve for using just the radial galaxies, that's shown here as these dotted lines, or using the supernova plus radial galaxy combined data set, which gives us much tighter constraints on our model parameter beta. When we do that, we find that beta, this is the combined supernova and radial galaxy data sets, is 1.5 plus or minus 0.15. So it's a 10 sigma determination of beta. Okay, it's a long way from zero. These are definitely not Eddington-limited systems. They're nowhere near prediction for an Eddington-limited system. Okay? So, and we show that our model parameter does not, it has no covariance with cosmological parameters. So we cannot trade off our model parameter for cosmological parameters. And I think that would be a very interesting exercise to do with supernova. Can you do an analysis that includes both the model parameter and the cosmology, and is there any covariance between those two parameters? Can you trade off your model parameter for cosmological parameters? Okay. It just turns out that in this case, you cannot. Okay. There is no value for W or omega, lambda, or any other cosmological parameter that we've studied that will change the value of beta. Okay. No covariance between those quantities. Now, once you start talking about beta, you're talking about the physics of the supermassive black hole. So you can use these to study the physics of supermassive black holes. How many people here have studied outflows from supermassive black holes? Or are you familiar with the Blanford and Zinajec model? Okay. Well, the standard picture, I'm glad this is a school, a summer school, so you can learn about supermassive black holes. The standard picture for these radial galaxies is that you have a rapidly spinning supermassive black hole that's at the heart of the active galactic nucleus. And you're tapping that spin energy using a magnetic field. So this goes back to Blanford and Zinajec, I guess I didn't write it on this slide, 1974. And in that model, the beam power that you're going to remove from the spinning hole and that we're going to see deposited in the hotspots depends on the magnetic field that's threading the hole, the black hole mass, and what's called either J or A over M, the spin of the black hole. The total energy extracted depends on the spin of the black hole, A over M squared, and the black hole mass. Okay? So what we can do is we can see how our model parameter beta enters these relationships. Okay. We also, in our model, have the total energy extracted from the spinning black hole. Well, that's the beam power times the time it's on. Well, we wrote that time as Lj to the minus beta over 3. So the total energy extracted is Lj to the 1 minus beta over 3. Okay, so we can put that in here and this in here and solve for the way our model parameter enters these expressions, and it's through the magnetic field strength. Now, I was really amazed when I first wrote this down and saw how complicated this expression was. And the most interesting thing is that when we put in our best fit beta, okay, which is, has none of this in it at all of these terms cancel, and the B field depends only on the spin of the black hole, A over M. Okay. So that's why the radial galaxies work as a cosmological probe. Okay, the reason they work is because the jets are being produced, in every source where the jets are produced, the B field is proportional to the spin of the black hole. It does not depend on other factors, such as the black hole mass, which is different for each of these sources. And I'll be showing you the black hole masses in a minute. Okay? So that's why this works. Okay, so just to put it in a nutshell, The use of radio galaxies for cosmology and to study the physics of the supermassive black holes depends on a couple of very simple assumptions. One is that the time, the total time the AGN is on, is written as a power law on the beam power. Okay? It doesn't assume anything about the environments of the sources. It doesn't assume anything about the beam power. Okay? It has very, very few assumptions in it. Now, once you know the value of beta, you can solve for the total energy removed from a black hole, the total energy expelled by the supermassive black hole. This is the energy that will be expelled over the total lifetime of the black hole. Okay, so it's not an instantaneous measure. Now, if you just go to a standard textbook on supermassive black holes, you'll see the total energy of a spinning black hole, which is written here as E star, is related to the mass of the black hole, capital M, speed of light squared, and J. Okay, so J is the black hole spin. It's A over M. Okay, so it's defined in terms of the spin angular momentum per unit mass, right here, of the black hole, little a, and the gravitational radius M. Okay, so this is a standard parameter that shows up whenever you study the spins of black holes. Now, this energy, E, the total energy extracted from the black hole, we see in the radio-emitting region. Okay, so we're going to assume that the energy used to power the radio source comes from the spin of the black hole. So we can solve for J. Okay, we have this quantity E, and we have the mass M of the black holes. So we can solve for their spin. And really, we view this as a lower bound on the spin. Because maybe not all the spin energy is extracted in one outflow event. Okay? So here's the spin. This is R. That's the total energy extracted and put into the radio emitting region. This is the black hole mass. Okay? And this we put into here and solve for the spin of the black hole. We're going to take that to be a lower bound on the spin. So the only assumption here is that the energy source for the outflow is the spin of the black hole. It doesn't depend on any particular model for the energy extraction. And there are two types of sources, including in this study. These are central dominant galaxies, often observed at low redshift, and they have big radio-emitting halos. So these are generally found at the centers of clusters of galaxies. Okay? And this radio emission is used to get the total energy expelled by the supermassive black hole. Okay? So this sample comes from Rafferty et al. And these are the powerful FR2 radio galaxies that we've been using for cosmology. This is what the total energies look like, and this is what the supermassive black holes look like. So these black hole masses are in units of 10 to the 8 solar masses. So these are direct determinations of black hole masses determined by other groups. And this is the total energy expelled by the black hole for the powerful FR2 sources, the very, very powerful radio galaxies that we use for cosmology. This is the total energy extracted in units of 10 to the 6 solar masses. For these other central dominant galaxies, this is the total energy that we count up looking at the radio emitting region. So we solve for our lower bound on J. Okay. First of all, we notice there's very, very little dispersion for the powerful radio galaxies. And in fact, they all have exactly the same value. Okay, so I'm going to return to that point. It's about 0.1. They all have the same lower value on the spin, 0.1. Another way to say that is the energy per unit mass that they put out in their outflow is exactly the same for all of the sources. And we see values here ranging all the way down to 10 to the minus 3 and up. So the lower bound on these central dominant galaxies can be quite low. If we plot those as a histogram, this is what we get for the supermassive black holes for the powerful radio galaxies. Basically, it's one spike. Every single source is in this spike. Okay, and we studied 19 in this sample. There were 19 of our sources for which black hole masses have been determined by other groups. And these are the central dominant galaxies shown here, going down to 10 to the minus 3. Okay? So for the powerful radio galaxies, this has a mean value of 0.12 plus or minus 0.01. They all have the same value. It's within one sigma of the value of every single source. They both evolve, both the energy, okay, the energy and the mass evolve as 1 plus z squared. Okay, so if we looked at the energy as a function of redshift, it's evolving very strongly. It's also evolving very strongly as a function of radio power. So we were very surprised to find out that the ratio is independent of everything and the same for every single source. Okay. All right. Now, as I mentioned, because this is obtained using beta of 1.5, we're getting a total measure of the total energy that will be put out by that source over its entire lifetime. We're not just looking at the radio emission that's there. And that's giving us part of the reason we have such a small dispersion. For the central dominant galaxies that I showed you, the total energy is being counted up using the radio emission. And that gives you a very broad dispersion in the energies that you have. So you don't get a measure of the total output over the whole lifetime of the source. So for the 29 central dominant galaxies, we got a very large range of parameters. But there was one source, actually a few sources, with lower bounds that were really high. Okay, so there was one source where you can put a lower bound on its spin of 0.4. The maximum possible value for J is 1. Okay, that's the maximum possible value for J. Okay? Now, there's another way that these can also be used to study the spins of supermassive black holes, and that's by looking at the beam power. So the results I showed you there use the energy and the mass of the black hole. But you can also look at the beam power. Okay. Now, to use the beam power to study the spin, J, which is equal to A over M, you have to specify a particular model. And we looked at the standard Blanford and Zinyag model, published in 1977, and Myers' model, which is very similar, published in 1999. Okay. And in those models, you can write down the beam power that the black hole is going to put out in terms of the black hole mass and the magnetic field that's threading the hole and extracting the energy. Right? So what you can solve for here is the product of J times B. Of course, we'll come back to the point that we've already determined that B is proportional to J, as I showed you earlier. But right now, we haven't put that in. And this directly allows you to solve for J and B, the product. Now, a maximally spinning hole has J of 1. That's the highest that can be. There's also a maximum value of the magnetic field strength. And that's called the Eddington magnetic field strength. That's when the magnetic field strength has an energy density equal to the energy density of radiation emitted at the Eddington luminosity. Okay. So the B field cannot be larger than that, right? So we parameterize the magnetic field strength in terms of the Eddington field strength, and then this product must be less than 1. So this is bounded to be less than 1, J times B, okay? So now we're going to solve for that and see what kind of values we're going to get, okay? Since both J and B must be less than 1, that product must be less than 1. So we use the same sample of sources and the same black hole mass determinations. And if we look at the beam power as a function of black hole mass, we get this figure here. Okay? So we see that the beam powers of the very powerful sources we use for cosmology are up here. Okay, these are up at 10 to the 46 ergs per second. Those are our empirical determinations. And here are the beam powers obtained for the Rafferty et al. Central dominant galaxies. And here are the black hole masses. So in the context of the Blanford and Zinyag model, we solve for the product JB. And lo and behold, these are all 1. In other words, both J and B must be 1 for these sources. And that's the lower bound. So the lower bound and the upper bound are the same. All of these are maximally spinning black holes, basically. Okay. So that's what, if the Blanford and Zinyag model is the correct model for the energy extraction of these sources. Okay, if we go to the Myers model, this decreases by 5 to the 1/4 power. It decreases by a little bit. And here are the results for the central dominant galaxies, the Rafferty et al. Sample. Interestingly, this does evolve with redshift, and in fact, this evolution is predicted in models for structure formation, the growth of structure formation, the coalescence of supermassive black holes. Okay, so this is what we see, that at very high redshift, these are all of order one. Maximally spinning black holes with maximum magnetic fields. This is slowly decreasing with redshift down to values of about 0.7 for the most powerful radio galaxies. Here, there's a very broad range of values for the central dominant galaxies, and this is subject to very, very strong selection effects. Okay, so this is, these are lower bounds on J and B here, okay, but to make a stronger statement, we have to look at all the selection effects in detail, and I'm not going to go into that today. Now, as I mentioned earlier, looking at the using these for cosmology, we figured out that beta was 1.5. That was our model parameter, 1.5 plus or minus 0.15. And we used that to conclude that the magnetic field strength was proportional to the spin of the black hole. So we can now put that in here. And instead of looking at the quantity J times B, we can just solve for J. All right? Since B times J was 1 for a large quantity of a lot of the sources, that tells us that our constant of proportionality is of order 1. Okay? So now we solve for just the spin in the context of the Blanford and Sinaitic model. And they're 1. It's 1 for most of these powerful radio galaxies, and all of them are greater than 0.1. Okay? So these are the values for the spins of the supermassive black holes in central dominant galaxies. They all have values greater than 0.1. And this is what the spins look like as a function of redshift. Okay, starting at values of order 1 at a redshift of 2, this is going out to a redshift of 2, and dropping slowly, values of about 0.7 locally. Okay. Even some of the central dominant galaxies have very, very large spin values today. Okay, so this is at redshift of about 0.3 or so. All right? So what have we learned? First of all, we can use these sources to study the spins of supermassive black holes. And this can be done in two ways. Okay, one is to assume that these outflows are powered by the spins of supermassive black holes. We can then look at the energy of the outflow and use that to place a lower bound on the spin energy of the black hole. Okay? We combine that with the black hole mass to solve for the black hole spin J. You can also use the beam power and combine the beam power with the black hole mass to study the spins of these systems, and then you're studying them in the context of particular models. Now, I should say all the models have the same functional forms, and they just vary in the constant of proportionality by a very small amount. So all the models out there right now look very, very similar. The most interesting result, I think, is that the energy per unit black hole mass extracted in the powerful radio galaxies is the same for every single galaxy. Okay, about 0.2%. Now, as I mentioned, when we look at these galaxies, there's a huge range of radio power. There's a huge range of redshift. There's very strong evolution of energy with redshift. Okay, but when we look at this other parameter, it's the same for every single source. So that's telling us that this outflow is triggered when they all have the same physical state. The outflow is triggered when the energy per unit black hole mass of the outflow is this value. Okay, the same for every single source. This places a lower bound on J of about 0.1. That's the spin energy that's used up in each outflow event. That's a small fraction of the lower bound we're getting using the beam power and the mass. When we look at the lower bounds we get on the spin using the beam power and the mass, we have values of order 1. So only a very small fraction of the spin energy is tapped for each outflow event. Okay, that's what we can conclude from that, suggesting that we have multiple outflows for each source. A Another very interesting result is it's telling us that the spins are of order unity at a redshift of about 2 and dropping to values of about 0.7 today. Now, there are many, many different predictions out there for the growth of supermassive black holes and their spins. And there are two models, two of those groups have predicted the behavior that we see. The behavior that we see for the spin as a function of redshift is predicted when the accretion events onto the black hole are sporadic and occur over a series of time. Okay? So that's the model of King and Pringle. And in fact, the results we obtained for the evolution are very, very similar to what they predict in their model. In addition, Hughes and Blanford predicted an emerger model, the way that the spin of the supermassive black hole would evolve with redshift, and it's very, very similar also to what we obtained. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. Thanks. See if there's any questions. Well, we're using the dimensionless coordinate distance y. Let me go back to that.
Right.
So you can't just arbitrarily change the normalization.
Well, if I scale r, right?
Well, it's coming from that quantity m star. So this is the equation that is used to solve for the coordinate distance to supernova. And this is an observable modified by a model parameter. And this quantity, capital M star, absorbs the local distance scale. This is the absolute magnitude of the supernova at peak, which is a constant for all of the supernova after you've modified their apparent magnitude over here. That's actually the way this is done. So in practice, this is something that you solve for. It's called the nuisance parameter. It absorbs all the local physics. It absorbs Hubble's constant, and it absorbs any inflow, an inflow model. This can be obtained by fitting the data in the context of particular models. Okay, so you can solve for this using a quintessence model, a rolling scalar field model, a lambda model. It turns out no matter what model you use, you always get the same value for this constant. So this is, in a sense, model independent. But this is the constant of proportionality that you're talking about, I think. Does that answer your question? In other words, if you wanted to convert these dimensionless coordinate distances into coordinate distances here, you would need a value for Hubble's constant. Okay, this method does not require a value for Hubble's constant because that is absorbed into this quantity. So then we solve for y of z, and in h of z, we're looking at y prime. So when we plot y prime of z, and I was saying that we do not put in a normalization, it turns out to be 1 at 0 redshift. It actually is not always exactly 1, but we're getting the first derivative of the coordinate distance at 0 redshift using the data within our window function. Okay. So we have this data. These are the dimensionless coordinate distance y. They're kind of blurred here, but there's a data point here for every single point, every single supernova that went into this sample. And we solve for y of z, y prime of z, and y double prime of z at each redshift here. Okay, and then we show those on a separate figure. So here it is. Here's y prime of z. So it didn't have to turn out to be 1 at 0 redshift. And in fact, early on, when we had much, much smaller data sets, it was coming out to be numbers that were offset from one by more than one or two sigma. And we debated whether or not to renormalize, but we decided not to. So you can't really renormalize, you can't arbitrarily renormalize y or y prime or y double prime. They're coming from this expression here. And the same thing happens with the radio galaxies. Okay? This is your constant of proportion, this is your constant that all this has to be equal to. And then given that once you have that constant, you solve for your coordinate distance to each source. Now, our uncertainties are larger because we include the uncertainty in our model parameter when we solve for y for each source. But that constant could have been different for each model. Let me show you where that is. We have a figure of that. It does turn out that, luckily, that is independent of the model. So no matter what model we use to solve for that constant k, which I'm going to get to in a minute, I hope, that constant k, it's this ratio, which has to be constant. That constant k does not have to be 1. Okay, it's some number that shifts up and down. But it just turns out that what that value is, when we analyze the data in many, many different models, it's always the same value. So it's constant. Okay.
Your dark energy indicates things?
Yes. Well, let me go to that. That's down here. I think. No, it's up here. The reason is that, first, it has a lot of power at low redshift. Okay? So, you can see from this figure here that if you're studying S, the difference between different values of W0, even if W is evolving with redshift, whether or not W0 is equal to -1, the zero redshift value, you can see this parameter is very, very sensitive to deviations of W from 1 at zero redshift. So that's the first reason. It's a very good way to go. The second reason is that the goal here is to put all the uncertainty on the theoretical side of the equation. So we try to write down a quantity which has no theory in it. This quantity has only the coordinate distances and the derivatives of the coordinate distance. There's no theory in this. And we put all of the theory, so to speak, on the other side of the equation, trying to separate the data from the theory. So we can write this down for the data, and that is never going to change. The only thing that changes are the curves that we compare it with. And I drew 3 on here, but you could predict other curves and put them on here and see which one provides the best description of the data. And that is also the goal when we look at y prime and y double prime. And I didn't get into that here. But the idea there, I mean, even h of z and q of z, you have, they're still pretty pure, so to speak. I mean, the only thing you really have to say about this is omega sub k. So you have one kind of theoretical input that you have to pick to say what the data tell us about h of z here. And q of z also, although we did show the effect was very, very small. If you go to y prime and y double prime, there is no theoretical input whatsoever to what you're determining from the data. And you can put your full uncertainty into the on the theoretical side of the equation. So you could compare your theoretical prediction with y prime and y double prime, okay, and leave your everything to be determined on the theoretical side.